Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project, promoting informed discussion of issues related to California's state governance and civic engagement. I'm Zabre Valentine, Director of Voices of Reform, and I want to thank you for joining us to discuss two ballot initiatives on which we all are going to be asked to vote on November 8th, Proposition 76, dealing with budget reform and education spending, and Proposition 77, dealing with the way political districts are drawn, known as redistricting. The Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform programs are made possible by the generous support of the James Irvine Foundation, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and Commonwealth Club members. Today's program will be moderated by Rebecca Corral, midday anchor at KCBS News in San Francisco. Ms. Corral, a San Francisco native, has been at KCBS for 15 years and in the business of providing news to you for 25 years. And now I am very pleased to turn the program over to Rebecca Corral to moderate today's discussion.
Thank you, Zabre. It's good to be here and talk about the upcoming election, and to see that people have actually decided to come out on their lunch hour because they want to know more about some of the issues on the ballot. A dear and brilliant friend of mine has named this coming election, nicknamed it the Four A's. She says it's about abortion, Arnold, ads, and apathy. So what we want to do today, she's a television producer, they're good with that quippy packaging. We want to do battle with the last A, perhaps the last two A's. Think about the ways in which you prepare to vote. There, you know, are several levels of that. Some people look at the ads, listen to the ads, and even the most sophisticated voter is not immune to the advertisements. At the very least, it informs you in a sort of rebellion way. The more sleazy the ad, the more likely some people say, okay, I'm definitely not voting for what they're pushing. The other level would be newspapers, television, radio, news stories, and much as I hate to say it, some of those stories are put together by interviewing the public relations folks for each side of a particular issue or a candidate. And all of the information that they might give during their interviews is not necessarily fact-based. They're doing a lot of spinning, and you're getting a lot of spinning. And the more responsible among us interview political scientists, analysts, like the two gentlemen we'll be meeting today, but, you know, you're still voter beware, I think. And there are obviously a variety of additional sources. The League of Women Voters, Project Vote Smart, the Commonwealth Club has a wealth of materials for you. And the Commonwealth Club is now promoting house parties, which is what we have today. That's why we brought all our little, you know, I was told party, so I brought gifts. I don't know if this goes well visually, but there. Okay, you got blowouts. Use them. Party hats. It doesn't take much. You invite friends over, maybe some neighbors, make it a potluck. You know, the smartest people you know and the people that you like and the people that you trust. They're probably who we become informed by the most. It's the people we trust and the people that we think perhaps know more than us. So here are the men that we're speaking with today. Addressing the issues related to Proposition 76 will be Fred Silva, the Senior Advisor for Governmental Relations at the Public Policy Institute of California. Mr. Silva has been involved for over 30 years in the development of public policy related to state and local government. He's worked with the California Council on Intergovernmental Relations, the Office of Planning and Research, and he served as the Chief Consultant to the Senate Local Government Committee. In 1981, Fred Silva was appointed to the position of Chief Fiscal Advisor to the President Pro Tem of the State Senate. In 1994, Mr. Silva was selected to serve as the executive secretary to the California Constitution Revision Commission, which was created to examine the structure of state and local government, the state budget process, and the state-local relationship. He's also authored the State-Local Fiscal Relationship in California, A Changing Balance of Power, which reviews the history of the tension between the state and local governments. Addressing issues related to Proposition 77 will be Robert Stern, president of the Center for Governmental Studies, a nonpartisan research organization located in Los Angeles, which studies governance and media. Mr. Stern is an expert on the redistricting process, as well as campaign finance and ethics. He's a past chairman of the Council on Governmental Ethics Laws, an international organization of state, federal, and Canadian agencies that regulate campaign financing, ethics, and lobbying laws. Prior to his current position with the Center for Governmental Studies, Mr. Stern was general counsel for the California Fair Political Practices Commission. In the early 1970s, he was elections counsel in the California Secretary of State's office and was counsel to the Assembly Elections and Reapportionment Committee of the California State Legislature. Bob Stern has written for many publications, including opinion pieces for the Los Angeles Times, the Sacramento Bee, and the San Diego Union Tribune, and you can hear him once in a while on KCBS Radio as well. So without much more, we're going to start with an overview of Proposition 76. Fred Silva's going to provide that for us. We'll ask a few questions, and you'll get an opportunity as well. Fred?
Thank you very much, Rebecca. What I'd like to do is to involve you as the Commonwealth Club in the history of budget reform in California. Prop 76, although we may not think about it, is one of a long line of budget reforms. The first one was actually sponsored by the Commonwealth Club in 1922. The reason that we have a unified state budget here is because the Commonwealth Club of California sponsored an initiative measure to create a strong governor unified budget. It wasn't long after that there was another budget reform process that occurred in the 30s through a special election known as the Riley-Stewart Act, when budget reform was very much a topic in California. Issue then was a spending limit, and what the measure did was to say that if the budget grew by more than 5%, it would take a two-thirds vote to pass it. If the budget grew by less than 5%, it was a majority vote. Today, we still have the remnants of that in the form of the two-thirds vote requirement for passing a budget. In 1979, there was also a special election called to establish a different kind of spending limit. This was a limit to on the appropriation of the proceeds of taxes. In other words, it was to limit tax revenues and how they were spent. This came out of a very difficult period where the state had a spike in revenue. The state had a surplus in 1978 of $4 billion. That was $4 billion of a spending base that was $12 billion. The treasurer at the time suggested that that was an obscene surplus. And so a debate went on in the legislature for over a year about establishing a spending limit. Sure enough, an initiative came along to establish that spending limit, and the voters approved it in a special election in 1979. That spending limit is in the Constitution today. It was exceeded a one time, had a tax rebate. Many of you may have remembered in 1986 that you got, if you're a joint filer, you got exactly $237 from the state in the form of a tax rebate. These were amounts that were rebated in excess of the state spending limit. Now, we move the camera forward all the way to the late 90s, and we know about the issue in regards to the revenue increases that occurred in the late 90s, the fact that there were tax increases done at the same time and spending obligations made so that it created a gap between revenues and expenditures. Beginning in the 2001-2002 session of the legislature, then Assemblyman John Campbell introduced a spending limitation to revise the current limitation. And there was a great debate that went on about that, a debate that didn't involve very many people because the legislature never heard the measure. Along came the 2003-04 election, legislative session. Sure enough, John Campbell is back with another measure, again, to put in a new spending limit. The concern was that whenever there was a spike in revenue, both the legislature and the governor had the propensity to simply spend that money, so that when there was a slowing of the California economy, a further gap would develop because there weren't sufficient revenues to fund ongoing commitments that had been made. Now, along comes the Schwarzenegger administration, and they decide that it's time to put the issue of fiscal reform back on the public's agenda. And they had a choice. They could either use the template that was provided by Senator Campbell and his ideas, or they could look at other options. In discussions with business leaders, they chose a different approach. And what we're going to talk about here shortly is exactly the approach that they took, which is what we know now as Prop 76. And what I'm going to suggest is that although Prop 76, as many of you have hopefully read it or read the legislative analyst's analysis of it, it does many things. But I'm going to focus on just three of them and perhaps the three most important. The first is that it establishes a new type of limitation on state spending. The old limit, which just limited the appropriation of tax revenue, this limits all spending. And it does so by placing a limitation that is driven by the average of state revenue over the prior 3 years. Their objective is to smooth out these spending spikes, if you will. And in order to accomplish that, their conclusion was to simply take the revenue growth over the prior 3 years and have that be the limit on the following year's budget. Now, to the extent that there are revenues that exceed that, then those revenues are placed in three three pots, if you will. One of them is 25% of the excesses would go to the reserve. We now have a constitutional reserve, which we have not had in the past. It was in Prop 57 that you all voted on at the last election. 25% of it would go to infrastructure expenditures for schools and for highway and transportation expenditures. And then 50% of it would go to pay off the accumulated debt that the state has incurred through its budget borrowing. In the old days, the state used to have two ways to balance a budget. It was either by expenditure limitations or tax increases. They invented a third, which is to simply issue long-term bonds in order to finance state spending. So a portion of that excess would go to pay off those bonds. That's the first thing that this measure does. The second thing that it does is it grants the governor new power to make reductions during a fiscal emergency. From the middle 1930s until 1983, the governor had the ability to reduce appropriations in the state budget almost at will. There was no standard for when he could or could not do that, but there was statutory authority for him to do that. That went away in 1983. So now the only time the governor has the ability to reduce expenditures is when he or she receives the budget as enacted by the legislature on his or her desk and can reduce items of appropriation in the signing of the budget. Other than that, there are no budget reductions that cannot be done without the approval of the legislature. This will grant the governor, under certain fiscal emergency circumstances, the ability to make reductions on almost any appropriation. There are some limitations, of course, that are included in the measure, but for the most part, all appropriations in the Budget Act are subject to his ability to veto under certain fiscal emergencies. The final thing that it does is it revises the K-14 education guarantee that was placed in the Constitution in 1988 and revised in 1990. And the long and the short of the guarantee says basically that schools and community colleges are guaranteed an amount of money that is the same as they received in the prior year, plus growth in enrollment and per capita personal income. This is a growth index that was put in the Constitution in 1988. In 1990, there were revisions made that said if the constitutional limitation during a recession is an amount that is in excess of per capita general fund revenues, then the schools get the smaller growth amount. All right? This measure comes along and says we're going to get rid of this recession reduction so that schools will always get the prior year plus growth. And the other thing it's going to do is it's going to say that appropriations in addition to the amount of the guarantee won't go into the funding base. So remember I said the prior year plus growth? The prior year won't have in it any appropriations for schools that are over the amount of the guarantee. And this is partly what you're hearing in the argument about it. How much will the base of school funding really grow? Anyway, those are the three major things. As I mentioned, there are some other bits and pieces. But as you're reading it, think about those three things. A new limitation that will go on and sit parallel to the old spending limit that's still in the Constitution. There's new powers granted to the governor, and there's a change in the way the K-12 school guarantee operates.
All right, before we go to the audience questions, Fred, I wanted to ask you, is there a model for this?
No. there are a number of states have different spending limits. There are virtually, I would argue, there aren't models that could simply be lifted out of one state and applied to another because state fiscal systems are so different. The current debate going on in Colorado, which has a spending limit, is that limitation is constructed in a much different manner than our old limit. And I think we're best, if we're interested in expenditure limitations and things of that nature, to sort of look at our own system to decide what sort of system we want to have work in California.
Who drew this up? Who contributed to cooking this up?
The debate went on a year or so ago between the business community leaders, that's the California Business Roundtable and the California Chamber of Commerce, in a debate that went on with the administration over what kind of spending limit should be placed before the voters. As I mentioned, Senator John Campbell had a measure, and there was a debate that went on about how restrictive a spending limit ought to be.
Can you tell us what's good and what's bad about it?
Well, it isn't a matter of what's good and what's bad. It's a matter of how voters want to look at fiscal rules. One of the things it does is it changes the balance of power between the legislative and executive branch. Now, if you're worried about that, that's a thing to focus on. If you're concerned about how spending limits work, and this spending limit does not include a tax rebate like the other limit does, you'd want to evaluate it in that way. So it's sort of an evaluation of how you think the world ought to work. Additionally, with respect to schools and K-12 education, if you're concerned about how the school guarantee operates, then again, you have to make a choice here. How should school funding grow? And the issue here is mostly overgrowth. And how should the baseline for school finance work?
Looking at these three components, do they belong together? Specifically, does the education component belong in here with the first two?
The more comprehensive you make a budget reform proposal, I think in the end, the better, simply because there are components of it that need to be taken together. The majority of state spending is for education these days, always arguably it has always been that way. The K to 14 guarantee, rather, is about $36 billion out of $100 billion general fund. So it's very, very important. So if you're going to talk about spending limitations, you have to talk about education finance.
But are we talking about education or merely education finance? I have a difficult time keeping those together or divorcing them.
Well, in this case, you're talking about education finance.
Thanks very much, Fred. We're going to move over to an overview of Proposition 77 now with Robert Stern.
Well, thank you very much. I am co-hosting a house party this Sunday, and I'm going to start off the house party by saying there's really good news and bad news about this election. The good news is that we only have 8 propositions, as opposed to 16 last year. The bad news is that all 8 are pretty complicated, particularly 76, which I think is probably the most complicated of the measures. I think when most of us woke up this morning and we started thinking, if we did, about state policy, we thought about traffic, we thought about health care, we thought about education, crime. Probably very few of us thought about redistricting or reapportionment. We were saying, oh, my goodness, look at the district that I'm in. This is a gerrymandered district. Isn't this terrible? And we didn't get heartburn over it. On the other hand, there are 177 people who woke up this morning petrified, having nightmares that Prop 77 was going to pass. And those 177 people were incumbent legislators. They're very worried about it. Now, shouldn't we be concerned about it? Well, yes, we should, because I think redistricting and reapportionment affects health care, affects traffic, affects all these problems. The question is, how do you let the public know that it does? Redistricting can change the entire makeup of the legislature. It can protect incumbents. It can reward a party that will lose that has lost touch with the voters and keep the party in power. When I was in the legislature, I worked for the Assembly Elections and Reapportionment Committee. This was in 71 and 72. Legislators would come in to see my boss every day to talk about their districts, and they wanted to protect themselves and their districts, and that was their only concern. This is the major election reform proposal of the governor this year. And let's talk about what it does. Basically, it says that 3 retired judges will do the redistricting, not the legislature, but 3 retired judges who volunteer and then are picked through a process, and they unanimously have to agree to a plan that will do the redistricting for Congress, the Assembly, the State Senate, and for the Board of Equalization. They will have to create equal districts in terms of population. And that, of course, is what redistricting is redoing population, redoing districts so that it reflects the changing population in the state. They'll have to have 2 assembly districts within 1 Senate district completely. They'll have to have 10 Board of Equalization districts, 10 assembly districts and 1 Board of Equalization district as well, unlike the reapportionment that we have today where districts are just completely scattered. In fact, I was talking to a state senator the other day who's running for the state assembly because he's termed out, and he said that his state senate district has 4 assembly districts in it, parts of 4 assembly districts in it. Well, this would say no, he could have no more than 2. The redistricting plan will have to comply with the Voting Rights Act to protect minorities. It'll have to minimize crossing city and county boundaries. The districts will have to be as compact as possible. And the judges will not be allowed to use political data, not be allowed to use where incumbents live, how people have voted in the past. And then they will have to hold hearings around the state, well, at least one hearing before they vote on the final plan. Now, this was written by Ted Costa of the People's Advocate. It's supported by the governor, by Common Cause, by the Mexican-American Political Association. And they argued that it would moderate the legislature, that it would make the legislature more moderate, because right now all the races take place in the primary. And usually the most liberal Democrat will win in the primary, the most conservative Republican will win in the primary. And then the people in the general election really have no choice because the districts have been so gerrymandered that it's already taken care of. Remember, not in the last election, not one incumbent lost. Not one district changed party hands. The legislature in 2001 got together and said, let's protect ourselves. And that's what they did with this reapportionment. They protected themselves, so there was really no competition. It's been endorsed by major newspapers throughout the state. Now, it's been opposed by most Democratic legislators, a few Republican legislators, the League of Women Voters, the California Nurses Association, a bipartisan group of congressmen, the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund. And they say that a three-judge panel does not reflect California. It could be three white males, three old white males, probably, and does not reflect California, that the voters have to approve this after it goes into effect. And what it could mean is that the plan goes into effect, people are elected, and then the voters turn down the plan, and the people still stay elected and will have to then run either 2 or 4 years from now in new districts. But the voters get a chance to look at it. And there's no examination of voter behavior or registration. They say, how are you going to create competitive districts if you don't know how voters voted? And they also are very concerned that this goes into effect next year, and the reapportionment will be done in mid-decade. Remember, reapportionment is usually done every 10 years, but this will be done next year if they can do it, and we'll be using six-year-old census data. And the question will be, can the county clerks and the Secretary of State do this in time? And there's a real question about that. I heard a debate yesterday. Steve Poizner, who's the proponent, says that he is trying to set up a system for the next 100 to 200 years. And I was sort of taken aback. We've only been in a state for less than 200 years. So I don't think, even if this plan goes through, that it will be in effect for 100 or 200 years. But I think that is a very, very important that you take a look at this, that you examine it, you see who's supporting, who's opposing, but more importantly, you see, determine whether or not you think the redistricting needs to be changed.
Thank you, Bob. Who's picking these three judges?
The three judges are, first of all, the judges will volunteer. Then it goes to the legislature. The legislators can pick judges from the opposite party, and then they can also veto judges. And then after they picked a certain pool, it's picked by random. So it's fairly, I mean, there's some politics involved, but there's also some random selection. The interesting thing is that in the 1970s and the 1990s, the legislature and the governor couldn't agree on redistricting. And the California Supreme Court did the redistricting in the 70s and 90s. And most experts say that they did a far better job, a far fairer job, than did the legislature in the 1980s or in the 2000s.
So is anybody lining up now? Any judges queuing up now to volunteer?
I don't think judges will be queuing. It has to pass first before there'll be any volunteers. But this is going to have to happen very, very quickly. I mean, remember, we have June elections. Fortunately, we don't have March election primary elections anymore. If we had March primary elections, there's no way this could have gone into effect. But we have June elections. And this will have to happen very, very quickly. And there's some question that first of all, there'll be legal challenges, and so probably won't go into effect in 2006. But it could go into effect 2008.
And what are the safeguards? You said that political issues can't be factored into their decisions. How transparent is this process?
Yeah, the process is pretty transparent. They have hearings. They have to comply with all the Open Meetings Act. They can't be talking to people on the outside. I think the process is transparent. The question is whether they can come up with a plan quickly enough to have it go into effect in 2006. And the question is, given the criteria, and particularly the fact that they can't use where incumbents live, which I think is a good idea, but they also can't use voting behavior. How do they make competitive districts if they can't see how voters have voted in the past? So I think that while people say that we should have more competition, and we should, this may not be the right plan to do that. By the way, if we want to have competition in California, we'd have to have districts go from east to west, from Santa Monica to San Bernardino, from San Francisco to practically to Reno. And we'd have these 80 narrow strips going east to west. And then we could have competition because mainly the Democrats are on the coast and the Republicans are inland. Now, that's not going to happen, obviously. These districts have to be very compact.
Do you get the sense that the backers or the sponsors of this measure have these judges in mind already?
No, I don't. I think that they, I mean, you know, there are obviously hundreds and hundreds of retired judges, and they can be federal judges or state judges. And I think that the backers are basically saying anything is better than what it is right now. Anything is better than having the legislature do it. And we could just have three people from this room do it and have experts help them out, and they say it would be better than having the legislature because the legislature only has one criteria, and that is protect thyself.
But other than that, I mean, other than that one, and Don Parada's issues aside, other than that one protective element, what's the benefit of the way we have it now?
What's the benefit of the way we have it now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a political system. The legislators are elected by us. They obviously know the districts very, very well. There is one district that's a choice I have to tell you about. There's a district that goes from Santa Barbara all the way up to Monterey, just along the coastline, to have a Democratic congresswoman win. But, you know, legislators know their districts, and this is the way the system is done in almost all the states. Is that the legislators are the ones doing it. This has been on the ballot, by the way, several times in the last 25 years. It has always been rejected by voters in different variations. One year, Jack Lemmon, the actor, was the spokesman against it, and he defeated it. So I was wondering if the actor this year supporting it might counteract. But what's happening, by the way, is that the Schwarzenegger people have pulled the governor off the ads, and he's not appearing in ads anymore for it. Because of his popularity going down. So I guess the actor this year will not necessarily cause it to pass.
He'll be back. All right, we'd like to open it up for audience questions now on both of these ballot measures. You've got microphones on either side. Any takers? Because I'll just keep on going.
Well, I had a question for Fred.
Yes.
Fred, I helped draft the Political Reform Act in 1974. And in there, we protected the FPPC, the commission, by giving it a guaranteed budget, a statutory budget plus cost of living. Suppose in the future, not right now, but suppose in the future the FPPC were investigating a governor and revenues went down so the governor could say there's a fiscal emergency. What would stop the governor from saying, you know, FPPC, I don't like your investigations. I'm going to eliminate you. I'm not going to give you any money for this year.
You know, I think probably political peril would be the only limitation. Certainly, with the way this provision works, the governor can do any reduction in an appropriation that he can reach, and he'd be able to reach the FPPC appropriation.
Thank you. And we have a gentleman in the audience coming up to ask a question on Proposition 76 or Proposition 77?
76. Hi, Fred. Noel Perry.
Hi, Noel.
My question is, and I may not have this right, but I was listening to the radio yesterday, and Mr. Campbell was on, and he was saying that with Prop 76 vis-a-vis the education element, Prop 98, he said that in a recession, the reduction would be less with this proposition than it would be otherwise, but it reduces the upside when things are good. So my question is that correct, and can you tell us about that?
Yes. The good Tom Campbell, who is was the director of the Department of Finance, who is now on leave from that office, has a good sense of fiscal structures for sure. Basically, the current Prop 98 guarantee says that in a recession, that the growth in school spending will be the enrollment plus per capita growth in general fund revenues, which in a recession is always smaller, generally smaller, than personal income. This provision basically takes that I'm sorry, Prop 76 removes that provision from the Prop 98 guarantee, so that in a recession, when revenues are down, but if personal income is greater, obviously, than per capita general fund revenues, then schools will get more than they otherwise would have received under this provision that allows the growth in K-12 spending to drop.
And do we have any other audience questions? You can start to sort of make your way up while one person is asking so we can. Yes.
Sharon Bogus, I had a question on Prop 77 for Mr. Stern. Could you talk a little bit more about what types of legal challenges might be facing the measure if it passes?
Well, there could be a number of legal challenges, and they'll be much more creative than I can think of. But it could be, first of all, the fact of the 2006 election, I think, would be the prime challenge. They would say the census data is 6 years old. You can't use out-of-date census data to have a new reapportionment. And that would be the prime challenge. Now, the interesting thing is that this is an argument that has been posited by MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund. Turns out in 1989, they were pushing the L.A. County supervisors to do a redistricting. And the argument against them was you'll be using 9-year-old data in if you do the reapportionment. Wait 2 more years, do it in 1991. They said, no, we can't wait. We have to do it now. And there was a legal challenge to the reapportionment done by the L.A. County Board of Supervisors. And the federal court upheld doing it before the 1991 census. So we've had one court say you can use old data provided you sort of modernize the data and do what you can to make it current. But that will be the main challenge, I think, with the fact that we're doing a reapportionment. This is unprecedented in California. It's not unprecedented in Texas. You remember that Texas did a reapportionment a few years ago and knocked out some Democratic legislators. But it's unprecedented in California to have a redistricting done in mid-decade unless it's being done by the court in response to a challenge.
Anyone else? Bob, why try to eliminate boundary crossing between counties and cities?
The argument on that is that that cities have a community of interest, and that people that a particular city should not be divided into 4 different areas. That we should have one legislator who is really representing that city, as opposed to 4 legislators. Now, it could be argued that 4 legislators representing one city is better than 1 legislator representing a city. But mayors and county boards of supervisors always get up. I remember the hearings we had in the early 70s on this, and they would come in and say, keep Contra Costa together and keep Vallejo together and don't divide us up. I know the governor went to Elk Grove in support of Prop 77. He said, here's a street right in the middle of Elk Grove, and we've divided the city into 2, and isn't that unfair where here you have citizens on one side of the street in one legislative district and citizens on the other side in another legislative district. And I think the legislator was who represented one side of the street was a legislator who lived 75 miles away. And the question is, how could a legislator really reflect that community? Now, the big problem in California, though, is that every district, and this is a Supreme Court decision, it's not a problem, but every district has to be relatively equal in population. It used to be prior to the mid-60s that you didn't have to do that. In fact, L.A. County had 1 state senator, and so did San Francisco. And one state senator of L.A. County represents 6 million people. Now, of course, there are many, many more. The Supreme Court has said it's 1 person, 1 vote. Every district has to be relatively equal in population. And so you're going to have some districts that are spread out. You're going to have some districts that may have to cross city or county boundaries just because of the population differences. But this proposition says keep it to a minimum. Keep the districts as compact as possible and as closely within a city or county as possible.
Thank you, Bob.
I have a question for Bob on Prop 77. We've read about, you referred to Texas, we've read about moves in other states when one party or another, in some cases been the Democrats, some cases been the Republicans, get into power in the state legislature and they immediately move to redistrict to increase the number of seats or lock in seats. So we see a Republican governor in California doing the same thing. Is this move like those, or is it different?
Well, the governor would say it's different, obviously. The governor would say that we don't have competitive districts. We need more competitive districts. He also is saying, at least I think privately, if not publicly, I want a more moderate legislature. We have an extreme legislature, both on the left and the right. And I want more competition so that the legislature will be more moderate and work together. And so his argument would be, I'm not a Tom DeLay. I'm not necessarily trying to get more Republicans into the legislature. I'm trying to get more moderates into the legislature. And after all, you have John Doolittle from Sacramento, or north of Sacramento, one of the most conservative Republicans in the House of Representatives, opposing this, along with Howard Berman, one of the more liberal members of Congress from the Valley in Los Angeles, San Fernando Valley, also opposing it. And that the interesting prediction, what happened, they say, in 2001, and this is sort of a story, but I think it may be true, is that the Republicans and the Democrats went to the Republicans and said, you know, if you'll vote for this reapportionment, we will protect your seats. And apparently Karl Rove was involved in this and came in and said, you know, this would be great, just have a reapportionment that protects everybody. Because if there were a fair reapportionment, there is some argument that the Democrats would pick up 2 to 5 more congressional seats in California and perhaps jeopardize the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. And so the fascinating part is many Republican congressmen are opposing the Republican Governor Schwarzenegger because they're worried that it's possible that they might lose the House of Representatives if this measure passes and there's a redistricting done in 2006. Now, this is a lot of suppositions, clearly, and you know, a lot of ifs, but that's what's involved with redistricting. You have so many different scenarios, and you just don't know what's going to happen. And the one thing you can say is it'll be unpredictable.
Thank you, Bob. Yes.
I'm Jackie Jacoberger, and president of the League of Women Voters of California. So one of our main objections to Proposition 77 is the fact that it calls for the vote of the people. And we feel that that would be confusing. As it is now, voters are confused about initiatives and ballot measures. And we can see that perhaps, you know, one small group that had a whole lot of money could campaign against the approval of the plan when it went to the voters. And then the voters would just throw up their hands, you know, like they do with a lot of the others. Could you comment on that?
Sure. The proponents of this measure did some polling, and they found that the most popular part of this proposition was the vote of the people, because people who vote like to vote. Now, I happen to think that voters are fairly smart and fairly sophisticated, and by election day, they have a pretty good idea of what they're voting on. In fact, I've listed a challenge for people. Go back, and maybe Fred will be able to take this challenge because he's been around a long time. Go back and think of ballot initiatives that have passed. And think of a ballot initiative that passed in California that the voters regretted passing and that they threw up their hands and said, we were fooled into passing that. We didn't like that ballot proposition. We want to repeal it. Now, I can think of one, and I go all the way back to 64. And in 1964, the voters approved an initiative that banned pay TV. No ESPN, no C-SPAN, no CNN. It was declared unconstitutional a year later, but I think the voters probably today would say, no, we don't want to ban our pay TV, and would not approve that. But Proposition 13 would pass by more than a two-thirds vote today, in my view. And most of the propositions, if not almost all the initiatives, and I'm talking about initiatives that passed in California, I think the voters knew what they were doing. I disagree with a lot of the results, but I think that they were not fooled into passing it. So I have lots of confidence in the voters. And while it's possible that somebody could put something over on the voters, I have a feeling that probably these reapportionment measures went on the ballot would most likely be approved, just as judges are today, Supreme Court judges are likely approved. But it's possible, and you're absolutely right, it's possible that the voters could turn it down, and then they'd have to have another reapportionment, and then legislators would have to be running in different districts again in 2 years, and we could have that process over and over again.
You're listening to a discussion of Propositions 76 and 77, hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project.
My question is for Bob. You said that the basic idea behind Prop 77 was to increase competition in the political races. And then you told us that the judges wouldn't have any idea whether they were doing that because they wouldn't have any idea about voting records. And then you told us that compact districts weren't what we needed for competition. We needed elongated east-west districts. So my question is, are there better redistricting approaches to achieve competition?
Absolutely. I mean, for example, in Arizona, they say in their criteria that competition is one of the criteria. So I think that there are certainly better ways to achieve competition. But again, it boils down to the question, and this is sort of the ultimate question, do you want legislators drawing their own districts, or do you want an outside body drawing the districts? And then you have to take a look at, and actually most people say an outside body should do it. Even people who are opposed to legal voters would say legislators shouldn't be drawing their districts. But they're saying the devil is in the details and that this proposition is not the proposition to do it. And the league would say that the legislature hopefully will come up with a better plan. Now, I say don't hold your breath. I don't think the legislature will. But maybe there'll be another initiative that will be a better plan because this plan has lots of flaws. We did a study earlier this year called Drawing Lines, a Public Interest Guide to Real Redistricting Reform, and you can go on our website at cgs.org and take a look at it. And what we found is that this initiative has lots of flaws in it and that there are better ways to do it. But the bottom line the voters have to say is, a bird in the hand, is this something that you want to pass now or do you want to wait for something better? And that's the decision that all of us have to make.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Gina Ballaria, and I have several questions, but I'll try to keep it to two on Prop 76. That is the one initiative for me. I feel like I get all the rest. I know where I stand. 76 has been a little difficult for me to plan out. So one is on the constitutional side of it. I know there has been talk about whether it's an amendment or a revision and whether or not it's appropriate to even be discussing it in this sort of venue. So that's my first question.
Yeah, on that question, the framers of the initiative system and later changes to the initiative system felt that it would not be appropriate to put a constitution revision, in other words, change the scope and nature of exercise of power through the initiative process, that the legislature can place revisions to the Constitution on the ballot, but an initiative can only amend a particular topic. It's sort of like a single subject rule that says, look, you can only do one topic. And when you do that, it can't make a fundamental change in the balance of power. Now, the question obviously arises not on the spending limit side or on the school finance side. It really arises on the question of a new power granted to the governor, and it changes in a fairly dramatic way the relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch. Now, whether or not that issue will wind up in court is hard to know, but that's the only point at which I think you might find the revision argument taking hold.
Okay. And then my second question is on the education side of things. It's been nearly 20 years since Prop 98 was passed, and there are still major problems in education. And I'm trying to get a sense if voters are ready to sort of try something new or if Prop 98 is still such a sacred cow that people won't be ready to let it go for something new yet.
It's hard to say. There are really two issues in the frustration over education. One of them is how education finance works. And as I mentioned, the easiest way to think about it is that the guarantee says that you get what you got in the prior year plus growth. And the issue is always a debate about how much the growth is. Now, if you turn to other issues, attainment and a variety of other elementary school related issues, K to 12. That's another set of issues that people have expressed concern about. Certainly, the surveys that the Public Policy Institute of California has done has shown that there's a general concern about the whole issue of K to 12. The changes that are proposed by Prop 76 to the Prop 98 guarantee really affect this question of how much the baseline spending is going to grow. We're still below the national average. The Prop 98 guarantee didn't do much to that. The guarantee really was enacted in the late 80s over a major dispute that went on between the legislature, the governor, and the superintendent of public instruction at the time. And remember that often these issues are time-bound. They're bound up in the nature of the politics of the time. And Prop 98 was written after an initiative measure that the California Teachers Association had placed on the ballot an election earlier and lost. So I don't know that whether your question about whether it's time for school reform, finance reform or not, obviously it's a concern of the voters. And so you would think that it might be time to look at the school finance and general school structure issue in and of itself, as opposed to a spending limit initiative, which the dialogue for which is all about education finance. It's not about the issue of spending limits.
And what do you see the passage of 76, if it were to pass, doing to the state-county relationships?
The long tension between the state and counties, because counties often operate as agents of the state. It's likely to increase tensions between those two, because as agents of the state, they rely on state resources to provide those services. In some states, the state actually operates its own health and human services programs. We've never done that. We've had counties as agents. The original Constitution in 1849 had counties as agents of the state, and they remain that today. So I suspect that when you get into a difficult fiscal period, then that tension is likely to increase a little bit, because that's where a great deal of state spending occurs. State spending occurs in two major areas. One of them is K-12, and the other is in health and human services, and most of those programs are run by counties.
This is a question for Bob. I heard someone say, and it may have been you, but I'm not sure, that if, in fact, Prop 77 passes, it would only result in the change in legislators in five districts.
I think I've heard that as well. The Rose Institute has done a study, and they say that it would create 11 additional competitive seats in the legislature and 10 in Congress, which is not half, but it certainly is more than we have now. I think there may only be five competitive seats right now. I think that may be what you've heard in the legislature. So to have, go from 5 to 16 certainly is not the majority, but it certainly means more people will have competition. Now, some people don't like the idea of competition, by the way. Some people say, that means the legislator will be putting his finger up to the wind and going either way and not sure where he's going to go, and I want my legislator to be with me, and I want to agree with my legislator. If it's competition, that means 50% of the people may be unhappy with the legislator, because the legislator will have to vote one way or the other. So there are pros and cons to it, but the Rose Institute, anyway, says there will be more competition, but don't expect every district to be competitive.
What does more competition mean?
Well, what it means is that a Republican has a chance of winning in a district that is has a slight Democratic registration lead. Right now, if you're a Republican in San Francisco, I mean, you don't have much say-so in November, do you? There used to be something called the open primary, which I thought was a really good idea. It would allow you as a Republican to vote in the Democratic primary and pick the Democratic nominee. And that moderated, in my view, the Democrats. Same with Democrats in Orange County or in, say, San Bernardino County. If you're a Democrat in there, you don't have much of a say in November. It's already been decided for you who your legislator is in the primary election. And so the November election means nothing. Competition would mean in November you would have both sides, both Democrats and Republicans and maybe independents, would have a chance of actually winning the election.
On the other hand, if you're a Republican in San Francisco or a Democrat in Orange County, perhaps you should swap houses. I mean, we are represented by the people who...
I think people in San Francisco would probably not want to move to Orange County.
I have a question for Fred on Prop 76. So I understand that the governor is interested in evening out spending so that we don't have these spikes in spending and situations where the governor and the legislature overcommit in one year where there's a lot of money and then they don't have it in the next, and they're sort of chasing it up and down. And as a result, and over time, we're accumulating debt in the meanwhile. But I've also heard people talk about that another way to deal with that is to look at the way we actually collect revenue. And I'm not talking about just raising taxes. I'm talking about changing the way revenue is collected so that the incoming revenue is evened out, which then would result in the legislature and the governor having an even incoming stream to spend. Can you address that?
Sure. The issue of fiscal reform has not focused on the revenue or tax side of this in a very long time. There was a period of time when state and local government was basically financed by a three-legged stool. The state had the income tax, local governments relied on the property tax, and both state and local governments levied a sales tax. So you had a tax on wealth, you had a tax on income, and you had a tax on transactions. And if you looked at the relationship between the three of them, they all sort of puddled along together. We've changed that. We have a a smaller reliance on the property tax for reasons we all are well aware. The state's income tax is a very progressive tax, so our reliance on the income tax has increased. The transaction tax, of course, rises and falls with recessions in a far greater volatility than does the income tax, unless you're talking about income from capital gains. So we're in a situation now where the income, the revenue side of this is in need of some discussion. Governor Davis appointed a tax commission in about 2001, to try to look at the topic. They issued a report with a variety of recommendations. I want to know how many of you, if you'd raise your hands, have seen or heard of that report or have it at home on your coffee table. Probably not very many. It's a boring topic, but it's one that we should ask. Steve does. Yes, very good. It's a topic that we ought to be engaging in, and we're not.
We are just about getting to the point in our program where we have time for one last question.
Fred, you know, you've been doing this for about 30 years. Give us two or three ideas about how we might make an improvement in budget decision making.
Oh, dear, Steve, no. Well, there are a couple of things. One of them is the legislative process itself and the relationships between the executive branch, their fiscal authorities, if you will, and the legislative branch authorities, and how they operate. This may get a little arcane, but the way we go about these decisions is very critical, and there's some attention ought to be applied to that. I mentioned the revenue side of this. The other is a specific reform that we ought to bring to the table, which is the so-called debt clause. The founders of this state and the authors of this early constitution in 1849 put a provision in that said you couldn't borrow more than $300,000 without a vote of the people. The reason they did that is because when they were drafting the constitution, the constitutions from the East Coast, which provided the model for it, were financing their budgets with borrowed money. And so these folks had the foresight to say, gee, let's put a provision in here that says if you borrow more than $300,000, then you have to have a vote of the people. Now, if you look at the current budget situation and the amount of debt that the state has encumbered for simply state operations, we didn't buy any buildings or build any roads or waste treatment plants with it. We simply borrowed money in order to finance prior year expenditures, right? Money out the door because the state was running these deficits, so we used borrowed money to finance it. The question is, well, if you read the debt clause and if you go into that section and read it, the words are what they say they are. But unfortunately, the state and I think the courts in part have stretched that limitation to the extent that they've allowed an enormous amount of indebtedness to be incurred. So my reform, if I had one to put, would be to revise the debt clause so that when the issue of spending obligations and tax obligations come up, then the body politic, the legislature and the governor, acting in some amount of comity between the two, can look at that and say, we have to either cut expenditures or we have to raise revenue in the form of taxes, or for that matter, we have to change the balance of what's priority with respect to state expenditures. Now, in the case of the run-up in state spending and tax reductions that were done in the late 90s, certainly they didn't borrow any money to do that. They simply spent it. But if you had a constraint here that said you couldn't borrow money to operate the government, I think that would go a long way to focus attention on spending priorities and taxation priorities.
I want to ask you each to take about 30, 40 seconds to give us a little advice. I'm a voter. What criteria should I consider in trying to make a decision about each of these measures? And, Bob, I want to start with you in redistricting.
Clearly, voters look to other people. I mean, having a discussion like this is very helpful, but what if you don't understand something, you look and see who's endorsed it, who's opposed it. You agree with those organizations. That's one thing you do. The second thing that you do is you go to your ballot pamphlet and you take a look at the analysis, the pros and cons. You go to the League of Women Voters, very nice pros and cons, very, very brief, short, gives you who's supporting and who's opposing it. So you have to do a little homework. The interesting thing, I'm amazed at the way voters operate. The people who vote really do like to vote. I was a polling captain in Southern California. We had a 93-year-old come in, took a cab in to vote, and she said, I didn't get my absentee ballot, and so here I am to vote. We had 18-year-olds squealing coming in saying, we're voting for the first time. People who vote take it very, very seriously, I think, and do a little bit of research. Don't necessarily rely on the 30-second ads, but do a little research, do a little homework, talk to your friends and neighbors, find out who's supporting, who's opposing, look at some of the newspaper editorials, and then use your own common judgment, common sense.
Thank you. And for state spending and school funding limits, Fred Silva.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with everything that Bob said, and I'd restate it. I think it's important that people read up on these topics. Certainly all the surveys that the Public Policy Institute of California has done show that the voters like to participate. So it isn't as though the complaints over the initiative process overwhelm their desire to participate. It's the other way around. Their desire to participate overwhelms the criticism. And I think people need to make up their own minds with all the information that's available. Some 10 or 15 years ago, probably, maybe longer, there was a lot of complaint about how much information was available to voters. Now there's an extraordinary amount of information. So it isn't due to lack of information about these measures, and it isn't just the ads, but it's rather all the written material. You can either get into a great deal of detail about it, you can get into a small amount of detail, but you all get to participate in this process and act as legislators, and you have to confront the same thing that legislators do. You have to make a choice. And the one thing you possess that you can't, that no one else can take from you, is your right to vote.
And I just want to say a brief thing. Since my children were very little, old enough to listen to me, which is zero, I have 0 years old, I mean. We always had a pre-election dinner where we'd sit down, we'd have whatever materials we'd gathered, mostly I gathered them, and we would debate measures, maybe do a little horse trading, try to convince each other, and they, of course, weren't voting, but they would go in with me and push the little pin thing. That is why I never voted through mail-in, because I wanted to take them with me and have them push the pin. My 24-year-old votes. My 16-year-old's very upset that her brother gets to vote and she doesn't. But it's turned them into voters. It became a part of their life, a part of the process. And so, you know, it's something to consider. We can turn out the next generation of voters. I'd like to thank our panelists for their contributions to tonight's discussion. They're Fred Silva, Senior Advisor for Government Relations at the Public Policy Institute of California, and Bob Stern, President of the Center for Governmental Studies. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.